shortly before you won the National Book Critics Circle Award.
I guess it was the occasion of the publishing of all the books, wasn't it?
It was the occasion, of the publication of O Albany.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah. And I think it was subsequently, a week or two later, that you won the...
National Book Critics, yeah.
And as I recall, I did a...
A
three-part profile tracing your whole history and career.
Yeah.
And mailed it to
you. It was nice. And I remember you sent me a tape. I listened to it going down in the car.
So what we want to do is to catch up on what you've been doing. Find out a little bit about some of the things that have been happening to you. Well, I guess it's been... When did you get that award? I've forgotten. 2 years ago? Or was it last year?
National Book Critics
was
January, the beginning of 84. And then after that came the... the Penn Faulkner Award, and then after that came the Pulitzer. I don't remember. I don't remember the sequence of
keeping all of your awards straight.
Yeah, the sequence. I don't remember.
Do you have them mounted on your wall?
Some, yeah. They were still I guess the Pulitzer's gotten nailed up, and so has the National Book Critics.
Well, tell me about the Today Show. You made an appearance today, huh?
Yeah, I talked about the ink truck, and I talked about the same situation. You know, the whole, she asked me for a rundown on the prizes, and Jane Pauley did. I guess it was a nice interview. I was on for a few minutes and spoke about myself again. That's what I do these days.
Are you nervous?
No, I don't think so.
I'd be very nervous being on television on the Today Show, I think.
I think my peak of overcoming nervousness was in Spain. I just came back from Spain, and I did a trip through Europe where the book is coming out in various countries. I was on the television speaking Spanish, so that's really brazen. I mean, my Spanish is fairly primitive. And
well, after all those years in Puerto Rico?
Well, I have a fairly good knowledge, but I never thought I would do that. But it was either that or not talk to the they were setting up in the hotel, and we were being interviewed in the lobby, and the public relations man for the publisher over there, Sex Baral, said, you're going to have to speak Spanish the way you... I was talking Spanish to the newspaper men, and sometimes I'd have a translator, and I could repeat and explain everything, but I had just in a few minutes. But I guess it went okay, and then the word got around that I was fluent, which is which is a big lie.
But was it just Spain, or are there other countries?
No, I did. I was a week in Sweden, and from there I went to Finland, where the book came out. The book was published simultaneously in Sweden, Finland, and Norway. So I made those three stops. And then I went to England, where I was for 2 weeks. All three books were published there at the same time. And I did Ireland for about a week, and then I did Spain for about a week and a half. And of course, Ireland is the same as England in terms of distribution of the books. And Spain, it was just Ironweed. But Billy Phelan is coming in about another 2 weeks, and Legs will be along in January. So, and I think they... Oh, no. And there's a number of other European countries also, which are going to publish it. France and the Netherlands and Germany and Italy and Denmark and also on this continent, Brazil. And, of course, Spain is the distributing agent for Latin American for that same translation.
Well, with the books just coming out, you're still relatively unknown in Europe, aren't you?
Yes, but I would think that this trip was, significant because of the publicity. It was really extraordinary. I mean, Sweden was just blitz, and Spain seemed that way, too. People told me that it's very unusual. I guess there's not that many American authors coming through these countries on these tours, and... I suppose there are some. Well, in England, of course, there always is. And I know Joseph Heller was coming in a couple of weeks after I had. Mailer had just been there. Gore Vidal was there at the same time I was. We crossed in the lobby of the BBC radio. And But in Spain, it's not the same. So that kind of a visit, and especially when you do a number of interviews all consolidating it, when people see it all at once and your face turns up in the newspaper every day for a week, people, it sinks in, I guess.
That must have been a wonderful trip, and you can take it off your income tax.
Yeah, well, sort of. you take some of it off.
Now, was the Ink Truck one of the books published overseas?
No. The Ink Truck is going to be published in England. It's just been republished here, really. So Viking UK will do it in England. My agent told me the other day that I think Germany just bought it, and Spain is, I guess, about to buy it. I don't know who else is going to do it.
Who was the original publisher of the Ink Truck?
The Ink Truck was originally published by the Dial Press.
Uh-huh.
When Ed Doctorow was the editor there, and Don Hutter was the deputy editor. And
Doctorow was the editor?
Doctorow was the editor, editor-in-chief at that time. And he and Don Hutter, I had a conference with them when they brought me in. And very soon after that, Doctorow left to write the Book of Daniel, to finish the Book of Daniel, and left publishing. And
he's coming out with a new, I think it's already out, in fact, a new book of short stories.
Yeah.
Brand new.
Yeah.
Random House bought that out, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I was amused by some of the critics who reviewed the Ink Truck. You were certainly a mature man when you wrote the Ink Truck, and the book certainly stands on its own, but the critics kept saying, in effect, well, look at the Ink Truck. It shows William Kennedy's early work as a young, aspiring writer, and look how he's progressed over the years. Actually, the Ink Truck holds up very well as a mature work.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I felt that it was enough of a respectable work to not touch it when I went back to publish it again. I read it again, and I wouldn't have known how to re-enter the consciousness of 1967, 68 when I wrote that. Either the consciousness of the age which was pressing on me, or my own internal workings. So the more I looked at it, the more I decided that, this is okay. I'm going to let this stand. I like it.
One thing so you did not like in the original Dial edition, I understand, the graphics.
Yeah, they were just sort of, it was an odd graphic in the part title pages. And it was presumably a newspaper, but you couldn't, since the newspaper was never really defined as such, it wasn't really a headline. These were supposed to be headlines.
They looked like a Russian alphabet, didn't they, and to a degree, what was supposed to be the headline?
Very curious kind of thing, and I never liked them. I thought they were awkward, and so this time out, they had a bold border, and it's an odd, looks like something one of those the English newspapers advertise every day, the headline on the street, broadsides, whatever, I don't know what you call them, with just one headline on it, on a big rectangular piece of paper. It's like a, whatever the hell it is.
Well, it's wonderful bringing out a new book and not having to write it. It's almost like having it's like having a fresh book, new publishing house, and new cover, and everything is different, but you didn't have to write it.
It's very pleasant, and it's a nice revisitation of that era for me.
Tell me a little bit about the new commission that you were appointed to by Governor Cuomo. What's the title of it again?
The commission. Are you talking about the Writers Institute
mm-hmm.
of State?
No, yes.
That's not a commission.
Yeah.
This is an outgrowth of an idea I had after I got the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship in 1983. And the MacArthur gives you this big chunk of money for 5 years tax-free. And along with that, they provide parallel grant to the institution of your choice, where a nonprofit institution where you decide to work. And that's $15,000 a year for 5 years. And you know, if you change institutions, you can change the grant to various places. Well, when I was teaching at Cornell at the time, and I decided that this $15,000 shouldn't just go down the drain. I should do some of the fellows who receive the grants don't use it because they don't they're not associated with any particular college, university, or anything else, and it just sits there. But it seemed to me that I could use it well by giving it to Albany and to the English department and having them bring in writers to speak with the writing students.
Now you're talking about the State University.
State University of New York at Albany, where I had been teaching as a part-time lecturer for 7 or 8 years. And so I offered it to them, and they thought it was marvelous, you know, because $15,000 to the English department there was a windfall. We never had that kind of money when I was there. I can remember one time we wanted to bring in a really good writer who was in the neighborhood, who could have come in and done a reading and a little conversation with some of the writing students, and all he wanted, well, it would have cost us was $150, and we didn't have it.
$150,
and he really needed the money, but he was just passing through. It was an afternoon or something like that, you know. He would have stopped and got off the train and been picked up and then get on the train and, you know, a few hours later. But we didn't have the $150 to do it. And that was sad, you know. And then the budget was always tight. It's always up against it for that sort of thing. And so the $15,000 looked enormous. So when I talked to the president of the university about it, Vince O'Leary, and he thought it was a great idea. He said, look, we'll match that money. Let's do something larger with it. And so what we did was a friend of mine up there, Tom Smith, professor in the English department, he and I put our heads together and sort of drafted some ideas about what we should do. And what we came up with was the Writers Institute at Albany. And that was designed to bring in writers and have them conduct seminars or stay for a week or stay for a day or whatever was possible for those individuals and pay some of their expenses, what we could afford, and then and this way have a certain continuing dialogue with some of the best writers in the world. Well, we started off last April with Saul Bellow, and it was an enormous success. And, you know, people hadn't seen that much of a turnout for a literary gathering in a long time, because Bellow draws crowds wherever he goes, but the fact that he'd come to Albany was very interesting. And so what happened was, on the basis of that, was the legislature, a fellow named Bill Passanante from Greenwich Village, he's an assemblyman, and he said to me in Albany one day, he said, that's a great thing that's going on, why don't we try to, you know, make it permanent and expand it, because after this grant disappears, the MacArthur grant only lasts 5 years, what are you going to do? Well, a new administration might or might not look favorably on continuing it. So he and people at the university and Chancellor Wharton's office, Cliff Wharton, they decided that they would design a bill to make it permanent. And the governor, Mario Cuomo, loved the idea, and the whole thing happened in about less than 2 months. And it went like a buttered bullet. You know,
are you the administrator of the program?
I'm the director. And they asked me would I do that, and I said I would. And so what we now have is the New York State Writers Institute of the State University of New York. And it's at this stage situated at Albany, but it has dimensions for reaching beyond just Albany. The mandate now is to establish a literary magazine, to give writers' conferences, to teach the various forms of writing, playwriting, screenwriting, journalism, and to, of course, continue this dialogue to with the best writers in the world. And what we've got so far, our first program under the new aegis of the New York State Writers Institute was Toni Morrison. And she came in early September, and just after school started, and we had another SRO crowd.
Well, you're the director, marvelous. But do you do the daily work on
it? No, I'm not doing that. Tom Smith is the associate director, and he's doing the daily work. And
I understand that you have purchased a house in Albany once used by Legs Diamond.
That's correct. He used it for about a week. And he used it to die in.
Why am I laughing? That's not so funny.
I don't know. Gene Kirkwood, the movie producer, came up to Albany. He's optioned Legs to make a film from it, and that looks like it's going forward quite splendidly at the moment. And he also optioned Ironweed. So anyway, he was in town to march with me in the North Albany St. Patrick's Day parade last year, and he came up not to march in the parade, but then since that's what I was going to do, he marched too. So did my Swedish publisher. We had a contingent of about 15 in the parade. It's a little mini parade that precedes the downtown parade.
Probably louder than the rest of the parade, too.
Wonderful of that. But anyway, I was showing Kirkwood around the town, and we were standing on the stoop of his house on Dove Street in Albany. And there was a for sale sign on it, and he said, why don't we buy it? I said, gee, that sounds like a good idea. And so we shook hands on the porch, and then we went out and bought it.
How much?
Let's not get into
that. You won't say?
Well, it's, it's, but I don't want to get into that. It's not a big deal, but it's, it's
what kind of house
a long mortgage on it, and split down the middle between us. We own it 50-50. It's like a two-and-a-half-story townhouse. It's from 1856. It's a solid little building. It's a very modest townhouse, very modest, and it's got a couple of bedrooms upstairs and a couple of living rooms and a kitchen in the basement. And
how are you using it?
I'm using it to work, and we sometimes stay there, and it's a very very livable little house. But I still live much of the time in the country, where I've always lived, in Avril Park.
Are you doing your daily work and your writing in the townhouse?
5 or 6 weeks I've been traveling, but I haven't done much then. But, I've been writing regularly over there. And
you're almost like a commuter now.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I've always been a kind of commuter. I've always had some place to go to work, to get away from the action in my house, which is a very busy place. I have three children, and they're all...
How does it feel working in a place where Legs breathed his last?
There's no spooks or anything. It's a nice little house. I've always wanted to live in downtown Albany, and it's a great neighborhood. It's right in the center. It's right next to the mall. It's in the Center Square neighborhood. It's a block away from everything you need in the world. And, I have no superstitions about it. It's nice. It's a good house, and it's very pleasant. It's got a little backyard and resident squirrels and such things.
How are you finding time to do what your original mission was, and that is to write, with all this traveling and this writer's project and all of the awards and all the honors and screenplays and all of that work? Are you indeed carving out chunks of your day so you can sit at the typewriter?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As I say, you can't do it when you're on the road, but I worked yesterday morning, and, I wasn't here. I'd be working now. My days are... This isn't going to last forever, this flurry of publicity ventures. It's important when the book comes out to give it its due, and... And European trip was a real pleasure, venture as well. So I think that there's a an end to this kind of excessive attention that's been going on right now, and then I'll get back to things. Will level off. They always do. Even in the worst times, get better, and the best times, you know. Jerzy Kosinski. I asked him once how he would describe success, and he said it's an interlude between failures. and there's a bit of homespun knowledge that I was always fond of. I feel that you know, we're in a high now, and it's going to give me time to write in another 2-3 months, and I'll be back in harness.
The last time we chatted, you were starting to work on a historical novel that was went way back in Albany's history, I think, back to the 1850s.
Right. That starts in 1849. It's still, that's what I'm working on. That's what's occupying my days. And it begins in 1849. It's one called Quinn's Book. And it's going okay.
Does that logically fit in with the other Albany cycles?
Yeah. It's an ancestor of Francis Phelan's grandson, Danny Quinn, same name. And begins with him as an adolescent in this year of 1849, and goes through the Civil War period on a little after. And it'll trace some interesting historical events in Albany's history and in the nation's history, but it's using those only to tell a story about.
Have you set a deadline for yourself?
Yeah, I've said I was going to deliver the book in 85, and I still plan to do that.
You're also doing some short story writing, aren't you?
I wrote a short story last year. No, I'm not, really. I don't know where that comes from.
Didn't that story appear in the
Harper's?
Was that in the best short story, the book of 1984?
I don't know what you're talking about.
The one edited by Updike? The book collection? Maybe not.
No. I don't know. Maybe there was one of my stories in there that I don't even know.
I think so. If it wasn't in the... I just got the book the other day and I haven't had a chance to read it. Either your story is in there, or in the back of the book there is a list of the most notable stories of the year.
Oh.
And you're mentioned. I know you're mentioned in there somewhere.
Okay.
With regard to that story.
Well, I wrote a story. I haven't been writing short stories. As soon as I start to write a short story, it turns into a novel. And I gave up on writing short stories a long time ago. I'd like to do it again, but I just now everything is geared toward focusing on Quinn's book. All my energies are in that direction, and all my whatever happens to me, I somehow can and turn it into material for the novel. Even if it's
how far away is the Cotton Club coming out? Do you know?
December 14th is premiere date, I think, if there is a premiere. But that's the release date.
Have you had a chance to see the product yet?
30 times.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen various versions of it. I've seen four different versions on the big screen, and I've seen worked with the cassettes of it many times. I love the movie. I think it's a terrific film. It's a vastly entertaining movie. But I'm sort of prejudiced. I worked on it for a year, but I hear very good things about it. I heard that they had a preview recently in Seattle, and it was so good that Coppola decided to go on vacation and went to. And stopped working, and now the film is just on the way to being.
Well, you'll be doing the screenplays for Ironweed, won't you? And
eventually, I'll be doing Ironweed.
Billy Phelan was that?
Billy Phelan, is half done, and Legs is finished. I finished that earlier in the year, much earlier. So, that's what I've been doing.
So, well. You've certainly been a busy man, and looks like there's not going to be an immediate end to it. I wish you the best, and I'm certainly going to look forward to Quinn's book.
Okay.
And hope to have you back talk about that. How did O. Albany do?
O. Albany is the wonder, I think, of it all. When we first published that, I was first going to publish it only in a paperback issue in Albany. My publisher up there is the Washington Park Press, and then as I started to write it, I felt that it had a dimension that would be interesting outside the city, and I got Viking interested in it, and Viking and Washington Park Press co-published the book. Well, the early notion was that if we sold 5,000 copies of a $25 book, it's got about 50 pictures in it, and it's a handsome book on very fine paper. And if we sold 5,000, we'd be doing okay. Well, they went back for a second printing even before publication, I think, or on publication. And the book is, I don't know, it's in its fifth printing now, and it's still in hardcover. They haven't gone into paperback yet. And Christmas is coming, and I'm sure the sales. It's the kind of book that people give at Christmas, and so I think that it's going to do well again. And I love it. It's 20 years worth of feeling about Albany and reporting on Albany and imagining Albany. And of course, it's all nonfiction. It has nothing to do with my novels, but it covers some of the same territory, like the death of Legs Diamond, for instance, and the politics, the remarkable politics of that city. It's still got the same political machinery that was put in place in the election in 1921, and it's still the Irish Democratic machine. It's a remarkable achievement in American politics.
William Kennedy, thank you very much for taking the time out. I know you have a busy, hectic life, but thanks for spending the last half hour with me.
It's wonderful.
Sorry I was 15 minutes late getting in. And as I got to the subway stop, I saw a taxi cab. And I thought, it's a rare to see a taxi cab during the rush hour. And I thought, I could grab this cab, or I could just duck down the subway stairs. Subway would actually be quicker if it's running. Sure enough, it wasn't.